Hello, welcome to episode 6 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I am Greg Weeks. I am a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today we've got Jennifer Piscopo, who is assistant professor of politics at Occidental College. And this is a mouthful. You are currently Peggy Rockefeller, visiting scholar at the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard University. Did I get all that right?
That is a mouthful. You did. That is a mouthful. But thank you so much for having me.
Okay. No, thank you. Jennifer studies gender quotas and representation of women in Latin America. But first, what's the work that you're doing there at the Rockefeller Center at Harvard?
So at the Rockefeller Center, I'm working on my book project, and my book project looks broadly at changing patterns of women's representation in Latin American legislatures over the past 25 years. And then it includes an in-depth case study of Mexico and Argentina, looking at, as women have been elected in greater numbers in both of these countries, what effect that's had on policymaking, and then looking even more closely at how women interact with each other across parties in the legislature to build coalitions that might advance policies that we would consider to be of interest to women, so policies that further promote gender equality or policies that further promote the interests of women in society.
Awesome. So you're in the middle of doing that research right now.
That research has actually been completed. Some of it came from my PhD dissertation, and some of it has been developed over the past few years. And what I'm trying to do at this stage is pull all of that research together into a nice narrative in the book. But I have a lot of quantitative data, and I have about 5 or 6 years of doing in-depth interviews with female legislators in Mexico and Argentina on 5 or 6 different fieldwork trips. So I actually have a lot of rich qualitative stories, and I have a lot of rich data looking at bill introduction and passage over time in these legislatures. And now I'm pulling it together into the story that I want to tell.
Awesome. Awesome. And that'll probably, some of that will get into the questions that I have. And just thinking about representation of women in Latin America, some of it, I know you don't do comparative studies with the U.S., but it's hard not to think about the train wreck of the U.S. campaign right now, with, you know, people's concerns about having a woman as president to begin with. And although it's not representation, just the way that women are being discussed in the campaign with Trump is, I shouldn't say it's unbelievable. I can believe it. But it almost seems like Latin America is so much more advanced in some ways, particularly with representation, and the public debate's more advanced. So can you explain how this got going, like gender quotas in the 90s, right? How did that discussion get going in Latin America?
Sure. And let me see if I can tease out various suggestions or comments related to your reflection on the U.S. I think the first thing to think about both for the U.S. and Latin America would be the distinction between the legislative branch, so that would be Congress, and then the distinction between the executive branch, right, which would be the presidency. And I think there's some unique features of women's representation in the executive branch that maybe we can circle back to later that might give us some more insight, perhaps on the Clinton-Trump conflict, we'll say, but sticking with the legislative branch for a moment. So the kinds of policies that I look at are called gender quota laws, and they were initially conceived of for the legislative branch. And what they say are that political parties must nominate a certain percentage of women to run for office. And again, that's for the legislative branch.
Right.
The gender quotas first sort of came onto the public policy table in Latin America in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Now, the Scandinavian countries historically, at the party level, had already done a lot of thinking about gender quotas for women's representation within the parties, women's representation as candidates, and then even some early initiatives in Scandinavia for women's representation on these sort of public supervisory boards that could be things like a water board. So we had seen a board to, say, manage the public utilities such as water. So we've seen quotas in politics globally before, but it was in Latin America that it was thought about in terms of a law, meaning a mandate, a statutory mandate, right, rather than a voluntary initiative by a political party. And it was very particular in Latin America around the context of democratization. And so women in various forms had been very active in pro-democracy or peace or human rights movements. So the classic example might be the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, who engaged in sort of human rights protesting to shame the dictators and their violations of human rights. When electoral politics came back into play in America as part of democratization and political parties reformed, there was a return to business as usual, where men who had traditionally been party leaders and traditionally been party candidates, you know, came back in to run for those spots in the first elections, what we call the founding or the initial elections upon the return to democracy. And the women's movements, who had been credited, right, with so much activism in bringing about democratic transitions, you know, the politically active women sort of said, well, wait a minute, where is our space, right? And so there was a moment with democratization, institutions are being rebuilt, they're in flux, the eyes of the international community is on you, and there was a lot of ways that women's movements could leverage this demand for quotas, shaming and blaming the political parties for coming back in and being just as misogynistic and machista as they'd always been. And so they were able to pass some of these early quota laws, Argentina being first in 1991 with a 30% quota. And then other Latin American countries soon followed. And what we then saw over time was these quotas becoming strengthened. So the thresholds would go up from 30% to 40% and then to 50%.
Okay, so, I mean, what you're really arguing, I think this is in the literature, right? It's kind of a critical juncture that this was this particular time where this sort of reform was possible. Is that why we don't see, is that partly why we don't see any similar type of movement in the United States? I hate to make it just comparative, but with all this stuff going on, I can't help it.
I think the critical juncture is really part of it, right? There's a sense in Latin America in the 1980s, in the 1990s, that you're redesigning your institutions, and there's a strong commitment to getting these institutions to behave right, and that demonstrating gender equality and demonstrating fairness and inclusivity part of what a good democratic institution would do, right? So I think that critical juncture does matter. I think if we look to the United States, there's actually several technical hurdles to a gender quota law beyond the critical juncture. So the first technical hurdle in the U.S. is that parties don't control candidate nominations, right? So Greg, you could stand up tomorrow and say, I want to run for office in Charlotte, and I'm a Democrat. And the party can't stop you from doing that. And if you get on the ballot and voters vote for you, well, then you're a Democrat. But in Latin America and in most other countries of the world, we don't have these independent candidacies. If someone wants to run for office, they have to be a member of the party, and the party chooses them to run for office, and then parties actually have to go to an electoral commission and register their list of candidates. So the parties are completely able to block someone, and they'd say, no, you can't stand up and run as a Green or as a Democrat because you're not a member of our party and we reject your candidacy. So when parties can control nominations, from a statutory perspective, you can tell parties, right, that their nominations have to follow certain rules, such as nominating a percentage of female candidates. Okay. I think that's the first technical hurdle. The second one is that in Latin America and in many other countries, we have multiple members in a district, right? We have what we call multi-member districts. So parties will not run just one candidate in a district like they do in the U.S. They'll run multiple. And then a quota can perhaps become more palatable because you fill the quota within the district, so you're not taking quite all of the seats in the district or all of the candidacies, I should say, away from the men. You're just taking some of them away. It's less of a zero-sum game at the district level in other countries the way it is in the United States when there's only one candidate, right, per district.
Right. No, that's true. It was just interesting when I was looking at the results of the Brazilian election, the municipal elections, two Sundays ago, and it noted that there were 32% of women who were candidates, and 68% of men, and the 32% was just over what I think was the Brazilian quota. But
right.
I was seeing that, like, oh, that seems really low. And then you look at the United States, where in many cases it's even lower than that, right? We only have 20%, was it like 20% of the entire Congress currently is female. So it's almost like in Latin America, because of this, the bar, while it can look low, is actually quite a bit higher than it has been and higher than the United States.
I think so. I think parties become, with the quotas, right, especially when they're well enforced, and at this stage in Latin America, they're quite well enforced, right? I mentioned those electoral commissions. The standard is that, you know, the electoral commissions won't let parties register their candidates unless they fill the quota. So there is quite strong enforcement. And that means parties have to really thoughtfully go out and look for and recruit women to run, right? And in the United States, because parties don't control candidacies in that way, right, local level party committees can certainly invite people to run. But because we have a system of independent candidacies where anyone can put themselves forth to run, right, then parties are not incentivized to recruit women or mandated to recruit women in the same way in the U.S. as they are when they know they have to follow a law about that.
Right. I was looking at an article you had just published in Politics, Group, and Identities about the shift from quotas to parity in Latin America. Can you explain the difference between the two and how that came about?
Sure. So these quotas that I've been talking about, when they were advocated for back in the 1990s, it was the same language of affirmative action that we're familiar with in the United States. So quotas were talked about as temporary special measures that were going to allow women to overcome discrimination, right? And that the hope actually was that quotas would go away. So you might have quotas for one or two elections, you know, parties are forced to recruit women, women enter into politics, everyone realizes that women are just as good politicians as men, discrimination disappears, and then you can remove the quota, right, and keep your now higher levels of women's representation. So that was the argument, and that was the hope, that it's a catch-up mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Of course, that isn't what happened in practice, right? The reason some of these quotas became stronger, as I mentioned, raising the thresholds from 30% to 40%, tightening those enforcement mechanisms. So often, the practice of the electoral commissions being very consistent in rejecting the party list when they didn't fill the quota. I mean, you had to work over time to get that enforcement in place. So because of that, people realized that it wasn't going to be quite this magical quick fix, right? That gender discrimination and sexism is more deeply entrenched. And as these quotas tried to become stronger to make numerically effective, because of course they're about candidates that are nominated, not about candidates that win. So parties might nominate 30% women, they might run them in losing districts, and so then the actual number of women elected is quite less than 30%.
Right. Right.
And then the idea was, well, let's raise the threshold to 40% so we can kind of try to keep moving that bar. But when it got to the point where people thought, you know, what we really should have is not 30% or not 40%, but 50% or parity or gender balance, you saw the arguments start to change, and they moved away from this language about temporary special measures, because now it's 25 or 30 years on, and it's clear these measures aren't temporary, right? In fact, they're becoming stronger and more permanent. And so the discourse started to shift to say, well, parity or 50-50 is about gender balance, and that that's actually the most true and the most fair quota because it reflects the distribution of men and women in the population, right?
Right.
And so the argument started to change and become much more justice-based and much more based on sort of a strict gender egalitarianism, you know, half and half.
Okay, and that justice rhetoric, I mean, that's only possible to even have that discussion because the quotas were put in place in the first place, right? Does that make sense? Like, that's
yes.
A more advanced discussion than you would have otherwise.
I believe that's the case in Latin America, right? And so over time, people became accustomed to the idea of quotas. They became accustomed to the idea of a mandate regarding the percentage of women. And so you could sort of ratchet that up, you know, from 30 to 40 to 50% over time. That might not be the case comparatively. So a really good example of that is the case of France. So France never had an earlier quota law. They just adopted parity. So again, gender balance or 50-50 straight away without passing through quotas first. And the argument in France was that this notion of parity or gender balance fit with the French philosophy of egalitarianism, right? And so that they didn't need the kind of earlier quotas as a training ground to perhaps in the way you did in Latin America. And I think once parity became more normalized in Latin America, you saw the Latin American countries picking up on French arguments, but they definitely did not get there overnight. But France tells us it's possible to go from zero to 50, metaphorically and I guess literally, without passing through quotas first.
Okay. And there was somewhere, I think it was in your article, you're talking about Costa Rica and how the public debate was not really acrimonious. It wasn't like some huge thing. I'm trying to articulate this well because you're saying that, you know, the original laws were supposed to be that these will have quota laws and they'll go away. Like in the United States, you have civil rights laws, and what the point is, eventually racism will go away. Everybody's being treated equally, so we don't need them. Now, why is there not a strong opposition voice? How is it that this has been so widely accepted? Or is that an inaccurate way of reflecting all of Latin America, that are there people fighting to say, hey, we just need to get rid of them and not strengthen them?
No. And I think that, again, you're thinking about Latin America and their experiences over time. So there's definitely still opposition to quotas and to parity. There's a debate right now in Argentina about raising its 30% quota to parity, you know, and there was just an op-ed, you know, written in La Nación, which is the leading newspaper in Argentina, against parity. So it's not to say that there's no opposition and that people don't speak out in opposition. However, that opposition is dramatically quieter or muted or less forceful than the pro movement. And I think it's for a variety of reasons. One, because quotas have been in place for so long, there has been a process of becoming accustomed to them. Mm-hmm. Two, I think the women who are in office in Latin America are extremely politically savvy, and they might not agree on across parties on abortion, right? But they all agree across parties. Again, there's always some people who disagree, but the vast majority agree across parties on quotas because it protects all of their political careers, right? Whether they're on the right or the left. And what's really amazing about studying these countries is how these politically active women have these cross-party networks and they engage in rigorous social shaming of people who speak against the quota, right? So they will come back and they'll say, this male party leader who spoke against it, he's a dinosaur, he's machista, he's sexist, right? And the public shaming is really strong. And then these women are supported by international institutions like UN Women, the Inter-American Development Bank, who have also adopted parity as their gold standards. So they're able to publicly place a lot of pressure on party leaders and make them look quite bad for opposing it. So people will complain to me about quotas in one-on-one interviews, but they often don't dare to do so in public because this shaming mechanism is very strong. And in countries that are particularly struggling to be seen democratic, when you turn around and you tell a male party leader that his opposition to the quota is undemocratic, that can be quite powerful, especially when you think about international reputations.
So when you're talking, I assume you're talking about male legislators who are complaining or male party leaders. Do they then say, I don't want my name used if you're quoting me?
That's interesting. Yeah. Oh, you mean in a one-on-one interview that I would do? They don't tend to tell me in one-on-one interviews that they are against the quota. They might if they're quite sort of extreme or perhaps empowered about it. But what they might usually say are things like, well, you know, we have the quota and it allows unqualified women in, or we have the quota, but some of the women that get elected aren't very good. So okay. You get those kinds of, You get those kinds of tangential comments that really are about resistance and really are about critiques, right?
Right. It's kind of a passive-aggressive thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
What kind of demonstration effects going on regionally? I mean, is each country then doing one thing and then the Brazilians look at the Argentines or the Argentines look at the Costa Ricans? How much of that goes on?
We definitely see regional learning and regional diffusion. Now, it's very difficult to model quantitatively, right?
Sure,
if we want
sure.
to talk statistical political science, it's difficult to prove, but we quantitatively, right? But qualitatively, we definitely see cases where these countries know where their other country, where, what the other Latin American countries are doing. There are constant events. They might be hosted by the Interparliamentary Union. Where female legislators from different countries or female party leaders from different countries will meet in regional fora. So there's definitely an awareness of what other countries are doing. And I do a lot of consulting with Mexico's National Electoral Institute, and they're the ones that enforce the quota law. And what they will often ask me to present them with is the comparative statics. You know, how is Mexico doing relative to Costa Rica or relative to Bolivia? So again, it's hard to model quantitatively how much this actually makes a difference right at the moment of voting to strengthen these quota or parity laws in the legislature. But anecdotally and qualitatively, I think there is a lot of concern and a lot of attention to that.
Well, because at least you can say, well, if we're going to push it up to 40, well, there's already two other countries that have it at 40, so it's not that big a deal, right? You start making that kind of an argument.
And I think it works with countries that are particularly concerned about international reputation. And the cynical view on this, now I also take the cynical view, but I'm happy if good policy is made for cynical reasons, right?
Sure.
The cynical view also is that often supporting these measures, adopting these measures, and aggressively enforcing them can be a way that a country can check a box. And so if you think about the case of Mexico, it has been extraordinary, actually, how assertive Mexico's National Electoral Institute has been about promoting and enforcing parity. Now, there's a lot of other political problems in Mexico that the National Electoral Institute has struggled to deal with effectively. Corruption in the political parties, vote buying in the political parties. And so I also think for countries particularly concerned about their international reputation, particularly concerned to show that they can run good elections and run fair elections, being on top of quota or a parity law provides them with one thing that they can show that they do well and that they can lift up. And it, in fact, might be a little bit easier just to change who the parties nominate and enforce who the parties nominate than it could be to weed out some of these more entrenched practices around clientelism and vote buying. And that's not to say there isn't a sincere commitment to doing that as well, but that it can be often be much more difficult, right? And quotas and parity could be a bit easier to implement.
And much easier to measure and point to.
Exactly, right? You've either ran a woman or you haven't.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. So in thinking of the skeptical side, the cynical side, so we have obviously pretty significant improvements in representation of women in legislatures. How has that changed mentalities in Latin America toward women? Does that create more equality socially for women? You know, that sort of thing. How much of an effect does that have?
Right. So this is what we as political scientists would call symbolic representation. So
right.
If women are represented in office, do they have effects on public attitudes? And there's been less research on this. Some global evidence, both from Latin America and elsewhere, suggests that when women are represented in office, they can have role model effects. So perhaps younger girls or younger women will be more likely to become engaged in politics or consider politics as a career, and that they could also have broader attitudinal effects. So, for instance, a recent study looking at female mayors in Mexico, not female legislators, but female mayors, mm-hmm. did find support for, in municipalities governed by female mayors, male citizens were likely to have less sexist attitudes than male citizens in municipalities not governed by female mayors. Okay. But it's important to say, what kinds of attitudes are these? So sometimes they can be a loosening of sexist attitudes towards women roles in public, but perhaps not a loosening towards sexist attitudes towards women's role in the home, right? So a study from India suggested that men might be more likely to accept having their daughters run for office when women are when they're living in municipalities with female mayors as well, but perhaps not more likely to accept that women would stop doing housework.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, of whether you can run for office as long as you're still cooking dinner.
Exactly. That can often be the most entrenched part, right? So greater acceptance of women's public roles, but women's private roles might still remain entrenched in some very traditional gender ideas.
Okay, well, great. We are actually out of time. Thank you so much for doing this, and your book manuscript sounds really interesting.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so again, this is Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics at Occidental College and currently a visiting scholar at the Rockefeller Center at Harvard University, and also at Jen Piscopo on Twitter. I know you don't tweet much, but this will be your plug, J-E-N-N Piscopo. On Twitter, so we'll get you to start tweeting a little bit more.
Yes, I need to work on that. If people want to tweet at me, I will answer them, and maybe that'll get me going. So please feel free to tweet at me.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll plug that on Twitter after.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye.